but you know, to be on the test track. But I want to thank you for coming, because this really does present some background on some of the products that we, you know, have been, I guess, developed here in our great state by 3M, and also how we can use those to make our roads much safer. So I want to thank you that this presents, I think, a different view for us. We talk so much about our infrastructure, but there's some things we can do to existing infrastructure to ensure that our roads are safer for our public. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Saltz.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Let me start with an introduction. My name is Jerry Carroll. I'm a technical director at 3M in the Traffic Safety Systems Division. And I've got responsibility for all of the research and development for our division. Just to give
Mr. Carroll, one problem. Could you be close to the mic there? We don't seem to be getting your audio.
All right. We'll try that. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's check with.
Check. Is that coming through?
Is it coming through? Okay.
All right. Thank you. Just to put a perspective on the R&D within our division, we have about 200 scientists, researchers, and technicians. That's all across the world, but about half of that number is actually located in St. Paul at 3M Center. And our mission is pretty simple, actually. We take technology in its pretty raw form, and we transform it into products that are useful for our customers. We're just one of many divisions in 3M. There are about 40 other divisions similar to us. But one of my favorite things about 3M is that technology is not owned by any one division. It's actually meant to be shared. And that's kind of the magic of our company. And this, if you look on the screen, this kind of represents that, is that the technical people actually share their technologies with other researchers from other parts of the company. And what it amounts to is that technology actually gets spread across many markets. And that's been a great a boon for our industry as well. We've been able to take technologies that originated in other areas and actually turn them into products for transportation applications. So this afternoon, I'm going to talk a little bit about pavement markings and about the performance of the 3M pavement marking products. Instinctively, you understand what pavement markings are all about. I mean, they're about navigation when you drive. And, of course, they play a role in the daytime. But in particular, they play a very important role at nighttime. It's important to understand, though, that what you see, you know, when you look at the road during the day, that's not going to be the same appearance when you see the road at night. And this is going to be especially true when the road is wet or if it's raining. It can be dramatically different. And driving at night, I assume everyone's a driver here, and so you've all experienced this. When you drive at night, it can be hard. It can be hard to see, and there's lots of reasons why driving at night in the rain is difficult. You get a lot of you get glare, you get distractions, but fundamentally, it's a physics problem. You know, it really is. And so what I'm going to do is just take a couple of minutes and go through a little bit on the science of reflectivity as it relates to pavement markings, give you a little bit of background, and I think that'll help you understand a bit more about the magic that we have within our own division. So I don't know if you've had a chance to, when you see pavement marking contractors out there and they're putting down brand new pavement marking lines, so it might be in the form of a paint, for example. First of all, they actually lay the paint on the road, but then they'll actually follow it up and sprinkle, spread these small glass beads into the paint. Well, those glass beads actually have a purpose, and that is to actually bring light back to the driver. And so if you can kind of see on the top of this slide, you've got light that actually leaves the headlight of the car. It comes to the pavement marking, and actually those light rays go to the glass beads. And this is where the light management and the physics come in. That light actually bends as it enters the glass bead, hits approximately at the back of the glass bead, and then starts working its way back to the driver, bending again as it leaves the glass bead, and then heads in the general direction of that driver. And that's the basic fundamentals of the retroreflectivity, which, by the way, actually works much the same way in the older forms of the sign sheeting. So it's glass bead technology is actually fairly well known. When the road is dry, this works just fine. You don't actually have any, there's nothing to interfere with the light between the headlight and the glass bead. So that light comes in directly, enters the glass bead, and then actually goes through its motions, actually bends a couple of times and returns back to the driver. So in dry conditions, you know, that's okay. That's why it's easier to see those pavement markings at night when it's a dry. But the game changes completely when you have wet conditions. And in fact, you can kind of see from this picture that there's a layer of water on top of the pavement markings and the glass beads. That really creates some big challenges in getting that light into the optics. First of all, if the water is quite deep, and so you actually have a layer of water over the glass beads, that water acts as a mirror of sorts, and so the light will bounce off of that water, that mirror, and then certainly will go off in the wrong direction, won't be coming back toward the driver. In most cases, light will go to the glass beads. At least some light will go to the glass beads. And you have enough disruptions in the water and things that you can get water to the glass beads. However, when conditions are wet, that water to bead interface actually causes the light rays to bend in the wrong direction, in the wrong way. And so even though the light might make the bead, the light rays will actually be bent insufficiently, and they'll head off in any direction other than where you want it to go back to, which is back to the driver. So this is fundamentally the reason why when you're driving at night in the rain, the pavement markings can literally go black. I mean, they can be completely invisible, and again, it's a physics issue. Now, do we care about this? Does it matter? Well, yes, it matters a lot. I mean, driving at night is hard enough, and then when you add the complication of water and rain, you lose your ability to navigate on the road using the most important navigation markers, which are those pavement markings. And studies have shown that accidents really increase in those conditions. I mean, in fact, it's three times as likely for an accident to occur when you're dealing with the wet pavement. So this is a serious issue. It's a serious safety issue. And I'm happy to say, actually, we can attack this one, and we can attack it with technology. And that's that's the beauty. I like to say that in our pavement marking area, we have invented products. They're the closest thing to magic that we've ever produced, and it's just they're absolutely fantastic inventions. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. 3M is one of its strongest technology platforms is called light management. Our company knows how to bend light, how to manipulate light better than anybody else, I'm sure. And of course, it even applies to this very laptop. You know, in the way that light actually comes out of the display. But we've been able to harness that same technology platform for pavement markings. And so I'm kind of holding up in my hands here two of these great inventions that I'm talking about. They're both glass beads, but they're different. One is actually designed to be very bright when conditions are dry, and one is designed to be very bright when conditions are wet. And so you can see some numbers on the screen. RI stands for refractive index. 1.9 refractive index describes the measure of how that light ray is actually bent. 2.4 is again, it's a different design. Light bends to a greater degree to basically compensate for that water that's over the glass bead. So this is the magic. I mean, and in fact, this even on the dry beads, 3M has designed something that's optimal for dry conditions, much brighter than traditional pavement marking optics. So we're able to actually put these two inventions together in really any of our pavement marking products in order to provide the best all-weather conditions. When things are dry, when things are wet, doesn't matter. And we'll actually give you the visibility that you need to be able to navigate that roadway. So, you know, later I can certainly pass these around. And I want to mention that those are the magic, but we have an ability to add to the functionality here. And so we take those glass beads, and in some cases we actually coat those glass beads onto a sand core. So just think about that piece of sand, and now you're actually starting to coat these very small beads onto that sand core. What does that do? It actually creates a little bit of dimensionality, gives it a little bit of structure, so that when you put it into the paint or the thermoplastic, whatever liquid binder you want to, it gives it it gives it a little bit of height, so that it makes it more accessible to the light rays. So there's a lot of technology that goes in here. It starts with the optics, but then we also design the whole system so that you can have a higher, as high performing pavement marking as you need for the conditions. So I talked a little bit about the technology. The technology manifests itself in a couple of different products that we could certainly talk to you about all day. The first one is called the 3M All-Weather Paint. It consists of all the optical devices that we have, all the optical elements, including the beads that work best in dry conditions, the beads that work best in wet conditions, and then a high-build paint. That means it's a little bit thicker, more durable paint than typical paint applications. So you put all that together, and you have a great all-weather performing system for, it's not going to last, years and years and years, but that's all you may want for certain situations. So it's a great high-value product for that situation. We also, in fact, I'll give you a kind of a blow-up of that structure. So you can see this is all-weather paint that you're looking at. You see the glass beads in there. Those are the standard glass beads that pretty commonly found in the market. But then, if you remember, I mentioned the sand core that's actually coated with the beads. That's referenced here as the 3M element. So those tiny little items on that element are those optics, are those glass beads. Okay, everybody with me? We also have a 380 wet reflective high performance tape. This is meant for a longer period of time, more of a permanent installation where that's going to last multiple years. So it's a rubber-based pattern tape. You can see a picture of it here, and actually there are these bumps that are on the tape. What's interesting, those bumps have a very important function in that the glass beads that our optics are coated on the side of the bumps. They're not actually on the top. They're literally adhering to the side of the bumps, and so they're protected from the car tires. Tires go right over the top. The beads are protected because they're on the sides, and that also provides the angle that's needed in order to get the light rays to the beads. This is such a wonderful, durable product, and it provides great all-weather performance. As you can tell, I'm proud of this. This has been a great effort out of the laboratory, and I could talk further about it, but sometimes you just have to see it to believe it. And so I'm actually going to show you a video. This first one, I'll set it up a little bit. It's in New York. It was one of our first all-weather paint applications. And so you're going to there's a line here that's black. It's an epoxy line, quite a fresh line. And if you're lucky, you might be able to barely pick it up.
Harry's going to turn the lights off here.
Oh yeah, okay. I can play it again too if that helps. And there's our line. There's our all-weather paint line. Can you see the difference? And then then we're going to run out of line here again. And now we're back to the conventional pavement marking. I mean, it's dramatic. If you're driving in the rain, I mean, it could be the difference about whether you stay on the road or not. I'm going to go back here to the. Oops. Yeah, wrong one. Okay, so I'm going to show you one other one too. I showed you the paint first. This is actually going to be a quick example of the tape. The previous one was more of a home video. This one is a bit better. But this is our 780 temporary tape, but it actually includes the same optics as you saw earlier. All right, and this is in Michigan, and you'll actually see coming up here there'll be some indicators as to what you're looking at. So there's our 781 wet reflective tape on the left, and then the 780, which is just white on the right side. And now you're looking at the conventional pavement marking, which is just a paint urethane. And then our tape shows up again on the right side. And so we're kind of going in and out of the conventional versus the 3M products. And you can see, I mean, there's a difference. I mean, you really notice when you're coming up onto the all-weather markings. So there we go again. So this one goes on for a longer period of time, but I think you get the idea. I realize I went through this awfully quickly. I know I had just a short time, but I wanted to at least convey the technology and answer any questions that you might have about the 3M technology.
Questions from the committee. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the demonstration. I was just curious on this demonstration here. I'm assuming that once paint is put down on conventional paint, it tends to lose its efficiency over time. In this demonstration, was that new paint that was the regular paint versus the 3M application, or was there something that was down there for a while?
Actually,
Mr. Carroll.
Thank you. What's interesting there is that both the conventional and the 3M paints, they were both pretty new. I think the conventional epoxy was about 3 months old, so still pretty fresh. But I will admit that the 3M paint was also new. You're right; it does wear. I mean, in fact the all weather paint is meant to last a pavement marking season or two. I mean, it's not designed to be a permanent installation. If you know that you were only going to be if you were going to be resurfacing that road in 2 years, this would be ideal. It's really a good value for that kind of time frame.
Thank you,
Senator Olson. Yeah,
Mr. Chairman, I think you answered, but I didn't quite hear you. Is the lifespan of this shorter or longer than the traditional paint? Obviously, the performance is different, but did I hear you say 2 years?
Mr.
Correll.
The all-weather paint, the 3M all-weather paint, it's a higher build latex paint, and so it's thicker, and so it has more guts. It will last longer, as much as twice as long as the conventional paint.
It lasts twice as long as the conventional paint, but it's about a 2-year lifespan. For the other year, you're painting every year.
I always have to hesitate a little bit in terms of locking down exact dates, because, for example, in Minnesota, you're dealing with the snow plows and all that kind of stuff, and that's pretty tough on a conventional pavement marking paint. But it does have more body. It's able to retain the optics to a larger degree. So we say it's nominally about twice as long.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Crowell, when you say about twice as long, do you have some sort of a gauge for it? For instance, when does it lose half of its refractive index?
We do have that data. And it's expected to drop off over a period of time. Typically we have a bar that we want to try to keep things about 100 millicandela. It's just a measurement of brightness, and so we've got data. Do I have all those on my fingertips? I don't. I apologize, but typically it's something that you can measure and you can decide when it's time to put down new. New material. I mean, it's something that certainly can be monitored and dealt with. So.
Senator Saltzman.
Just a couple remarks from our tour as well, Mr. Chair. With the tape and snow plows, am I correct in that when you apply the tape, sometimes you carve out a groove so that the tape is flat? And then I think that there was also some discussion about sort of a maintenance plan that 3M has, if I'm correct also, on that once the tape is installed, there's sort of a program that some states have used to maintain the tape. There's sort of a guarantee with it. Is that correct? If you might address those two questions, Mr. Carroll.
Mr. Carroll.
Yeah. Thank you. If it's okay, I'll answer the first question. I might turn to Gary and let him talk a little bit about the second item. Yeah, the what you mentioned about placing the tape in a groove is done quite commonly. In fact, I would say that's a best practice. Mm-hmm. So you actually create a little bit of a groove. Doesn't have to be all that deep, but actually then you're able to set the tape into the groove. Contractors like it because they know where to put the tape. And then you're right, that actually allows the snowplow blades to ride over the top of it without doing much damage to the tape. And so it certainly increases the lifetime of that pavement marking. It's a great way to go, especially in the northern states. Mm-hmm. And so, Gary, do you want to mention a little bit more about the maintenance program?
Yeah. Please state your name.
Gary Clark. I'm the transportation safety specialist representative from Minnesota. I've been here 20 years working with some of the people in the back of the crowd here. Two things. The first one that Jerry talked about, it's a liquid product. And it's more definitely more of a short-term product, a couple-year duration. MnDOT has experience of using our tape product since early 90s. In fact, the first project that was put down was, we call Spaghetti Junction out here, in 1992, and it was just recently replaced in 2006. And you all know what kind of traffic volumes are up and down that 94 Spaghetti Junction section out there. That was placed in a groove, and they were still getting good readings down close to that 100 level back then. But at the same time, they were going to replace those internal lit overhead signs out there, so the lanes were going to be closed, and then it is better, isn't it? So to incorporate the traffic control and to get the best bang for the buck when they're replacing the signs, they put new wet reflective markings. In fact, it's a contrast, has the black edge on that tape at the same time. So that's only been there about 2 years now. So before that, you've got, what, approximately 13 years from that product out there. And there are several instances or cases, projects around the state where you're getting the 8, 10, 11-year durability out of the tape already. So I would expect nothing different from this here using that groove. But we do have to get it out of the way of the plows. The liquid product for more durability, it's more of a rural two-lane type of application. There you could use the tape, you use a 100-mil groove. That tape you could probably, or the liquid, you probably go down to like a 25-mil groove, which is a whole lot less costly to do and get more durability out of the product if you get it out of the way of the plows.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
What is this that samples that were?
That is a Chevron. Senator Dibble was asking the other day when I was visiting, he wasn't sure what a Chevron was, so I just set those examples over there. That's a highway sign for curves. Like a Chevron to use on curves.
Is this a special material?
Senator Olson.
That's the material that MnDOT currently uses on our signs, yes.
Okay.
Nothing special. I just wanted to show a sample of what a Chevron was for Senator Dibble here.
Okay.
That's what that's for.
Now, you said that this was available on the tape and then also in liquid form. Is this also some of the product that we're seeing used more recently now in a powder form where there's a paint or an adhesive put down and then the material is spread over it? Is this that material also?
No. We only have it in a tape and this liquid product. Yeah. Yeah, high-build liquid.
Yes, we do have two versions of the tape, more of a temporary for temporary situations and one for more permanent installations. But yeah, tape and the liquids.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. On the paint application, is that, if it's a urethane or epoxy, is there a catalyst or a hardener when they're applying it? Or?
Mr. Carroll.
No, waterborne paint, and so it does require some dry time, and so you may have to have some traffic control until it cures.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Saltzman.
Well, perhaps this is a question for MnDOT later, but it's that my guess is that if we had additional resources, there are obviously other roads in Minnesota that could be using these products. So at this point, they're not on all of our roads, but sort of that there's an opportunity perhaps for additional business for 3M in this state. And that I'll ask maybe of MnDOT, but I think that that's the importance of this testimony today is that to hear about some of the safety improvements that we can be making and that the impact that it has on our public is very, very important. So I think seeing these kind of products is helpful to us as we move forward in making the case for additional funding for safety improvements, not just new bridges, new roads, but, you know, improving those that we have. So that's why I think this discussion today is very important.
Thank you. Mr. Clark.
Just to add to that, Senator Stallman, personally, I'd like to thank all of you for having the time here for us today and for your interest in these wet reflective markings, which I know, Kathy, you were down there at the safety site. And I also have to thank some people in the back of the room, Mr. Arsenault, Sue Groth, and their staff. I know there's some of them here. They've been very forward-thinking about doing some things. Like I said, they started using these durable products back in the early 90s. And they are just recently, there's a few projects they have out with the wet reflective materials around the state. So we do thank them for that. And also, to address the long-term thing, several years ago, Bernie and his staff, they made an investment in a scheduled siding replacement safety program. And I'm proud to say, because I live here too, this state has got the far most superior signs in any of the 49 states in the country just because of that program that they've done for the last probably 18 years now. And also, the Federal Highway just recently came out with some minimum reflective levels, and they can also be proud, as we all can, they are so far ahead of the curve, there's no worry there what you already have on your highways out there. So with all that said, and like I told Senator Murphy, who's not here, I was going to ask for some dedicated funding to support a striping program like they've done for their signing program over the last 18 years. So I thank you, and if you have any other questions, please ask.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone from MnDOT that would like to comment? Mr. Arsenault. And please state your name for the record.
Sure.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Perhaps we could ask LePage to grab those samples and pass them around. I think they wanted to show us those materials.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bernie Arsenault. I'm the director of the Office of Traffic Safety and Operations, and I'm here to present a little bit on how MnDOT utilizes some of the materials that 3M provides us with, and they have been great partners to us in providing safer roads for the public. What I'd like to do is kind of put this all in context as to how it fits in to the programs that we have at MnDOT, and then talk a little bit about pavement markings in particular, and also signing. Hopefully all of you have heard of Minnesota's Towards Zero Death program. Essentially what this does is recognize the fact that even one death is too many on our state's roadways. We've been very effective over the last 3 or 4 years in reducing fatals in Minnesota from around 650 down to below 500 in 2006 and 503 last year. That is through the application of some of the strategies that were developed as a part of our Towards Zero Death program, specifically within our strategic highway safety plan. It really is all about safety. Our goal is to reduce fatal and life-changing or serious injury crashes on our roadways, and there's a multitude of ways that we're trying to do that. But we are doing it differently than we did it prior to 2003. In the old days, we used to go and try and find locations where we saw a lot of accidents occur. The way we're pursuing safety these days is to look at serious and fatal crashes and try and determine similarities that we see amongst those crashes. And it really does change the way that we look at safety. The new way also recognizes, because of the data, that we need to look at all roads. We can't just focus on trunk highways. So we're working with our local partners to implement some of the strategies that the Strategic Highway Safety Plan has developed. We also recognize that we could not be functionally locked and only concerned about our own areas. So the engineering group is working with the education group and the enforcement folks and the emergency services, and together then we can have a much more comprehensive safety program. In fact, MnDOT and DPS are working as partners in the Towards Zero Death program. And finally, we're moving towards a more proactive and systematic implementation of our safety strategies as opposed to reactive. And that's largely due to the fact that as you look in greater Minnesota, you'll see that many of the fatal crashes occur there. We see 70% of our fatal crashes are occurring outside the metro area. And so those are much more random in nature than we see in an urban area where we have higher volumes of traffic. Also, I mentioned earlier, we're looking at local roads. You see here that 50% of our fatal crashes are occurring on the local system. So if we're really intent on moving our program towards zero death, then we need to look at all roads in Minnesota. By this little graphic, you can see that Minnesota does quite well, and I think that's somewhat due to the reference that was made earlier regarding our signing. We do, I think, a really good job of many of the ways of maintaining safety on our roadways. And you can see that Minnesota does considerably better than many of our surrounding states, but we still believe that we have a long way to go. Last year there was over 500 knocks on the doors, if you will, of two parents or husbands or wives that their loved ones were killed, and we need to prevent every one of those that we can. I mentioned our strategic highway safety plan and what that did by looking at the fatals as a whole and the serious injury crashes as a whole. It brings us to a new set of critical areas that we need to look at, and you can see that list here. The two engineering focuses of that we found were that these lane departure crashes, that's where someone leaves their lane for whatever reason, and either is involved in a head-on or cross median or hits a tree along the roadside, those would be a lane departure crash. And that's where these signs and markings come into play. But also intersections are the second most high areas where we see fatals. And again, signs and markings play a big role in that. Our strategic highway safety plan recognizes that there are many reasons that fatal crashes occur. And in the old days, we used to try and explain away why fatal crashes or fatalities should not be our measure. But we have since come to the point where fatal crashes are, or fatalities are exactly our measure. And in order to reduce those numbers, we need to deal with each of the areas along the right or left-hand side of this graphic. And you can see what accounts for many of the fatals that we have. And you can also see the progress that we're making in reducing that number. And we're very, very happy with that. But we know there's a long ways to go. This is a graphic that's in your packet. It's in the back, a larger one than in the beginning part of it. But you can see this shows our proactive spectrum. And it recognizes that there are some low-cost, systematic-type approaches to safety that we can implement on a broad scale. And those are the ones under the 70% column, both for intersections and for lane departures. And again, you'll see many of the things we're talking about in those lists. Now, specifically on pavement markings, MnDOT adopted a goal several years back that we would have an appropriate pavement marking on all of our trunk highways 365 days a year, and that involves presence and retroreflectivity. If it does not meet our standards, which we've set at 80 for yellow paint and 100 millicandelas for white, then it needs to be in the program for replacement. And this graphic here is just intended to show you a little bit of the relativity of the different performance levels of pavement markings. Our minimum, based on a study we did in Owatonna several years back, we've set our minimum retroreflectivity for pavement markings at 100 millicandelas, and you can see here where that lines up in the spectrum. 800 is about where we see brand new tape, the retroreflectivity of brand new tape that we heard about earlier today. And it, once you get into those higher numbers, it's pretty tough for you or I to detect a difference. But we can clearly detect a difference between 600 millicandelas and, say, 100 or less, or even 200. We recently, we're in the process right now, and we expect to have out any day now a new technical memorandum for pavement markings. We're taking a lot of the information that we've learned over the past several years by monitoring the different types of pavement markings that we have out there to deal with and to learn about their expected life based on, again, those two factors, presence and retroreflectivity. One of the key changes that we've made in this new tech memo is that we are allowing the substitution of wet reflective and or paint to those existing areas in the tech memo that call for tape or paint. This is just to give you a little bit of an idea of the amount of resources that we put towards pavement markings any given year. Last year it was between $15 and $20 million, and that's part of that's done through our striping business internally with our maintenance, and part of it's done through contracts with new construction. These are some of the things that we're doing to preserve our pavement markings. It was brought up earlier that some of these markings are put in recessed grooves, and that's in fact what we try and do, especially with our durable markings, those that are intended to last more than a couple years. And so we're doing several things. One of the things we've looked at is rubber plow blades so that we don't ruin those pavement markings or try and preserve them as long as we can. We're also dealing with late season cold weather pavement markings, and we're studying the effects and the performance of those markings. You can see we've got the wet reflective. There's another thing out there called rumble stripes, and that's another way that we're looking at to combine a couple of safety initiatives in one and try and create a safer roadway in so doing. And so what we do is we paint right inside a rumble strip, and that gives us a little bit of a vertical face that performs better under wet conditions and recovers quicker, and also contrast markings so that we can better see the stripe on gray roadways, concrete roadways, when we're using especially the new wet reflective tape that has a little more gray in it. You've got another chart in the back that shows where we've got wet reflective pavement markings today and also rumble stripes. So those are the two new things that we're doing, try and keep people on the roads, two new that we are doing amongst many other things. And then we're also this year going to have a study in Minnesota, and this will be monitored nationally. We're putting out 100 miles of wet reflective paint, and we will be putting that in a groove, so we're going to learn how long that high-build 3M paint can last in those grooves. And then we're putting out 310 miles of rumble stripes, and we're putting out 350 miles of wide lines. Right now we use 4-inch markings. We're going to put out 6-inch markings, and there's some really good information from the Texas Transportation Institute that shows that 6-inch lines can have an impact, and that's being learned as we speak, and so we're going to participate in some of that learning. I want to show you, this is the rumble stripe. This is similar to the two videos you just saw, but I want to show you in Missouri or Michigan. You're going to see right here there's no marking, or apparently no marking, and now all of a sudden we see a marking. That is a rumble stripe, and as we change lanes here, it's the same material, but it's in a rumble stripe. Again, this is wet. This is tape here. This is, again, a rumble stripe. We're going to come up to a bridge, and the bridge is going to take away any apparent retroreflectivity there right here, and then it shows up again as we enter again. And that was a little hard to see in this dark, but it shows, again, the benefits that we can get through some of the new technology that we're using out there. Very briefly, I just want to talk about signing because it's another area where we've used innovation, I think, to make our roads safer. Signs are a critical part of the infrastructure that we use to maintain safe roadways. And by improving those signs, you can see there are significant crash reductions that we can anticipate. This is a little bit of the history. I'm not going to cover that, but it shows that we have, through the years, stayed current with the technology that's out there. And the new sheeting, this DG3 prismatic sheeting, is really an amazing sheeting that we're using on our roadways today. One of the ways that this new sheeting has helped out Minnesota is that we no longer need to use electric lighting to light our overhead signs. The new prismatic sheeting that we're using has enough retroreflectivity that we no longer have that tail of and the maintenance of the lighting itself and also the energy used to provide that. Today we have very, very few lit signs out there. And then lastly, we talked a little bit about chevrons today. This is one application of chevrons. You can see how we use them on curves to let the driver know that they're approaching a curve and that they're going to need to take action if they want to stay in their lane. And to the extent we can improve that sheeting, that's all the more ability for us to get the attention of the driver and to keep them on the road and safely negotiating their trip. And with that, I would open to any questions that the committee may have.
I have one question, Mr. Arsenal. You mentioned the unlit signs, the lessening of the need of lighting. One thing I've noticed with the new headlights that cars are coming with, the high-intensity beams and the ones that are shielded, is that they're not lighting the signs like they used to light them. Is that going to be a new problem?
Mr. Chair, that's very observant, and in fact, that is a very significant issue that we're dealing with these days. Those are called cut-off headlights, and they're focused more on the roadway itself, and that makes the importance of this high-performing sheeting all the greater, and that is why we believe it's so important to get that sheeting out there. That DG3 sheeting that I talked about does accommodate, as the best of any other sheeting on the market, those lower or those cut-off headlights.
Senator Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's great to see this map to see where, you know, these products are being used. Is there some sort of priority list, or how do you determine where this section of road is? Has there been a number of accidents there? Are they targeted? And is there a list of where, like a wish list of where you would like to be able to use these sorts of products? Obviously, it would be wonderful to have them on all of our roads, but I think there was a comment earlier about having a specific fund for these kind of safety products. How do we balance that? Because these are probably the types of things that don't get done when we have emergency crises that we're trying to take care of. So how can we help MnDOT help you get these kinds of safety improvements on existing roads?
Mr. Arsenal.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman, that's a great question. What we are doing is trying to look in a proactive and systematic manner at the roads that are likely to have the best payback on some of these things. So we look at things like geometry, pavement condition, and volumes of vehicles as to where we put these. We have already gone through the exercise of asking our districts for roads for that study that I talked about. Mm-hmm. So we're going to see many more miles getting that. And then we've also asked the local governments through our central safety fund solicitation to local governments to provide us with locations or projects that could put some of these markings out on the road as well. And so there's a number of things that affect that, and we do try, even though it's a proactive systematic, we do try and identify those roads based on the factors I just talked about that are going to provide us with the greatest payback. Because it would take a lot of resources to put wet reflective markings across the entire system.
Thank you. We're going to try to move along rather quickly. Senator Dahl, if you have another quick question.
I'll try to keep it short. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a couple of quick questions. One is on, you have three different types of striping, the latex, epoxy, and poly. What factors determine, you know, what you're going to use in a particular area? Is there some factors that you use?
Mr. Arsenal.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl. Yes, there are several factors that we use, and it gets back to pavement condition, volumes, geometry in some cases. What we do on our higher volume, for example, divided roadways, we use a high-performing material in the center lines on the skip stripes and typically tape in Minnesota. And so we use that material there, and then we'll use an epoxy, what we call durable marking, which lasts somewhere between 4 and 6 years on the edge lines. We want to be out there as little as possible, but there are still a great need for latex, which is typically an annual replenishment where we go back and paint again with latex. But it depends on all those conditions, and we continually monitor the performance of each of these markings, including new types of material that we've got out on Highway 610, for example. We've got several different pavement marking types. And so we continue to watch that, and we have an inventory that we look at all our pavement markings and try and make the best decisions as to what we move forward with.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Dahl.
I may follow up on just a couple other things. Then in 2005, you had quite a bit more expenditures that year. Was there a reason for why that was such a larger amount of expenditures versus all the other years you got listed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, yeah, I believe that was because of the construction program, that was the driver for that change, because our internal, our maintenance of our roadways stays relatively constant, and then the construction program is what's variable.
And one follow-up, one last question.
Senator Dahl.
On this minimum reflectivity comparison, or the retro reflectivity comparison, you've got, you said that the minimum reflectivity is 180 versus whether it's white or yellow lines. And I'm looking at this chart, and I look at the 100, and I can barely see it myself. Is there a, I mean, what kind of eyesight do you need to be able to pick that up, or should we raise the standard a little bit, the minimum?
Mr. Arsenault.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, yeah, and I tried to reference that when we went through this. This is intended to be illustrative. The 80 and 100 numbers that we developed, and those are being looked at nationally. We're out ahead on this one as well. They're in the ballpark nationally. I think that they're likely to end up at the same level. These were the result of a marketing study that we did in Owatonna, where we drove many drivers along the course, and we tried to assess what was a adequate marking. Adequate. This is the low end of our acceptable level. And so when it gets to this level, we have already got it scheduled for renewal. So you got to remember, it's typically in the area of 200 to 300 millicandela that we're providing out there on the roadway.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Just quickly, and I'm sorry if I missed it, is that standard for wet and dry weather?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, that is for a wet, or I'm sorry, a dry condition. That is not for wet.
Okay. All right.
Well, thank you very much. This has been very informative for us, and it's great to see that something like this can be used to cut our deaths on the highway. I appreciate your presentation. Appreciate your help, Mr. Arsenault.
Thank you.
Our next subject is the Minnesota Department of Transportation budget review. Is that correct? I guess it's a system preservation overview. Okay. Did not have the total description here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Betsy Parker from MnDOT. I'm just going to make a few comments before Peggy begins. This is Peggy Reichert, who is our state planning director and is responsible for the development of MnDOT's state plan. And you are correct that originally there was to have been a budget discussion, but Senator Murphy asked that we come and talk about this state planning process instead.
Okay.
So that is why we are here doing this today. Some of you may remember that we talked about this in 2005. Randy Halverson and Abby McKenzie, who's also here today, made a presentation to this committee and to the committees in the House that deal with transportation and finance about MnDOT's state plan. State law requires us to redo our state plan every 6 years. Our last one was released in 2003, and we are due for another one in 2009. And as a result of the amount of time it takes to do it and the amount of input we get, we start about 18 months ahead of time putting together information and going out and talking to people about it in order to develop the plan. So this is just part of a long process that has just begun. And the other thing you might remember is that also we talked about our district long-range investment plans, which are what come after the state plan. We'll be doing that again in the future, too. Work on this plan began in the summer of 2007, and I asked Peggy to make a presentation about this to the legislative staff. We do presentations for staff a few times a year, just when we have more time to spend on things, just so that they know what's going on in the department, and they can come back and tell legislators about it. And I think that's how we ended up here today, because we did such a presentation for staff on Monday. One thing I would like to stress about this is that this presentation has been cut in about half from what staff saw. The presentation Peggy made Monday was an hour and a half, and we didn't think you would could devote that amount of time to it. So it has been compressed. But all of the same information is available. This was just kind of to pick what we thought you didn't already know or would need to know about where we were going. And the other really important thing is that no decisions have been made about any of this information that you will see. This is the beginning of a process that at the end will offer an opportunity to pick from a variety of choices about how the state proceeds with its transportation plan. So no conclusions have been drawn about this information, and no decisions have been made yet. We have many, many meetings and presentations to go through before we get to that point. And so now Peggy will do the rest of the talking.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Senator Carlson, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Peggy Reichert. Am I speaking into this? I work in the Office of Investment Management, and I direct the statewide planning program. And as Betsy said, that involves our long-range plans and working with all of our districts and also working with all of our stakeholders, the metropolitan planning organizations, the cities and the counties, and the private sector as well. And all of these folks are we talk with as we're doing this plan, and that's why it does take about 18 months. I did brief the staff on Monday, and actually I think we spent over 2 hours and had a really nice conversation, and so I am just going to hit the highlights here this morning or this afternoon. Well, wow. I'm going to just cover a little bit about why we're updating the plan, the approach, some highlights about some of the trends and outlook that we're involving, and then some of the implications about where do we go with this next plan update. As Betsy said, state statute does require that we update the plan every 6 years, and the last plan was done in 2003. And then the district plans that took the policies and turned them into actual investments and projects were completed in 2005. The federal government also requires us to have a long-range comprehensive transportation plan that addresses all modes, and it covers a 20-year time frame. And the Metropolitan Council is required to do that every 4 years to update their plan, and we work very, very closely because their plan and our plans have to mesh, and we're actually kind of working as a joint staff on this. Also, since 2003, there have been a lot of changes in the economy, in the environment. So we've had a lot of experience with how our performance-based planning has worked. Our stakeholders have said there are some new issues, there's some gaps, things we missed last time we did our plan. Our revenues and costs have changed since then. And I think we've all come to appreciate what I think at MnDOT we've always said preservation is our kind of top priority, system preservation. And certainly after seeing what happened this summer and then the floods in southeastern Minnesota, the critical importance of preserving the system. The approach we're taking is to basically update the plan that we had established in 2003. You may have seen this one. And update the 10 key policy areas and make sure that we address all modes. This plan was more focused on the highway system because that is totally within MnDOT's control. But now we also want to reach out and talk about all the modes, and including talking about what the railroads are doing in Minnesota, what the ports are doing in Minnesota, even if they're under private control. We're going to build on the plans that have been developed since then. We have a new aeronautics plan. The transit plan is being updated. Bernie's strategic highway safety plan is a real critical input to this overall plan. And also we're going to update those 2005 district investment plans concurrently. We're going to turn the new plan into investment plans. And as I said, we're going to coordinate with the Metro Council's plan that addresses both highways and transit in the metro area and coordinate with this Greater Minnesota plan for transit. We actually started last March and April going around to all of the area transportation partnerships and had meetings in all 8 districts and here in the metro area as well, and had between 100 and 150 people at most of those meetings and talked with, they were kind of our key stakeholders, and talked to them about what are the issues. And then we had our first steering committee meeting last June, and then we were going to have our next meeting in August, and events kind of took us off track for a few months. But we did get back in January. The steering committee met again. The steering committee is comprised of office directors and the district engineers at MnDOT and representatives of the city, county, MPOs, the regional development commissions, and all the state agencies. So it's kind of the governmental folks that have to deliver these products. And then we will be having outreach to the private sector as we go. So they got back together in January, and what you're going to see here today is some of the initial information to kind of set the context as we start to do this planning process, some of the basic trends and issues, and where do we go with this. Our plan is to be working on kind of this and to have our next round of major outreach to the public of telling them in May or June, perhaps after the session is over here, about this is what we kind of know now and what it looks like, we're the options that are under consideration. We'll be coming back and drafting the plan then and having another round of outreach at the end of the year, and then hopefully by March or sometime next spring, bringing together and formalizing the plan. But hopefully you'll kind of be able to see by a year from now really where this all goes. So some of the key trends. Minnesota is growing. It's forecast to have over a million more people by the year 2030, and of that, about 83% of that million is going to be in what we now call the Metroplex. It's kind of the Twin Cities reaching up to St. Cloud and down through Rochester. And then there is growth throughout the other parts of the state, but the bulk of this growth is going to be probably here in the Twin City and the Metroplex area. I don't have a slide, but also significant is that this population that we have is aging, and I think we all realize that we're going to have a significant percentage of the population in 20 years will be over 65, and that'll have an impact on how we design our transportation systems and even the type of modes that we want to provide. Another key trend is that traffic is growing, but the real significant thing is the last couple years it's been very flat. It's almost been no growth at all. In fact, it was like flat. That's had an impact, as you'll see later, on our revenue, which is all kind of gasoline consumption and driving based and new car based. And so that's a significant trend. We're not sure if we should go back to the 20-year trend line and say that's where things are going to go. If this new trend is a new trend, it's kind of good news. We've always wanted people not to drive so much, but now it has other implications. So that's kind of some, there's a lot of unknowns as we go into the future. Another big thing that we have seen, particularly since this decade, 2000, and more recently in just the last few years, has been incredible increases in construction costs, which has had a big impact, and you'll see more about how that impacts things. We have made significant strides in keeping our system in good condition and bringing it up to our performance targets. For bridges, for instance, we have we now are meeting our target for bridges in good condition, which is 55% of the system, and we've reduced the number of bridges in poor condition, has gone down to now it's 11%, and are in fair and poor, and in poor condition we're almost down to the target of 3.1%, and that reflects this reduction in the ones that are poor reflects, I know that everyone learned the term structurally deficient bridges, and we have over 3,600 bridges in the state altogether, and in 2001, 189 of them were structurally deficient, and by 2007, we reduced that to 107. The thing is that bridges are always, as they age, they start to get into this category of called structurally deficient, kind of like I guess we do. We're not really ready to go, but we're not quite what we used to be. So the thing is that we had a lot of the baby boomers that are reaching Social Security age are all those bridges that were, we call them baby boom bridges that were built in the interstate era, the 50s and 60s, they are all kind of coming of Social Security age over the next 20 years. So we are facing kind of the big bubble of the baby boomers. It's the same as the bridges. They're moving through. And so the last 20 years, and we've been able to do things, and we've done a really great job, but we do have this challenge of a bubble of bridges coming in the future. And it's just going to be sort of starting in the next 10 years, and then the 20 years after that, it's going to be more. So one thing about this plan, and I'm going to be sharing a lot of numbers here today, and I know in the past you've been talking about like the next 6 months and you're into precise numbers.
Could you move the thing just a little closer to you?
All right, thank you.
You're saying good things.
Thank you. Okay. I was saying that often when you meet here as a committee, you are talking about the next 6 months and cash flow and precise numbers. Here, we're trying to get a sense of scale. It's kind of like if you're 30 years old and you're trying to plan for your retirement. Can you afford to retire when you're 65? Are you going to have to work till you're 80? How much do you need to put aside? So we're really trying to get a sense of scale here. So none of the numbers are that I'm sharing with you are real, except some of these statistics, are really precise. But they're trying to get, you know, how big is the issue and what do we need to do? Another challenge as we go forward, we have the trunk highway system is 12,000 miles of roadway, and that's a lot of road, a lot of pavements to maintain. And we have been able to keep the roads that are in good condition, improve the number of roads that are in good condition. As you can see, from 2003 to 2006 or 2007, we've gone from 63% up to 66% of the principal arterials. Those are the major roads that carry the most traffic. And our non-principal arterials have also improved from 53 to 59%. The blue line is our target for the principal arterials. We'd like to be at 70%. The red line is our target for the minor arterials. So we've been doing a pretty good job on the roads that are in good condition, keeping them there. The light-colored lines out here, 2008 through 2011, that is our forecast of given what's in the current STIP, the State Transportation Improvement Program, which is the four-year program that we now just adopted that we're going to be building, that we have planned and programmed to build. If we build all of those, this is what we forecast the pavement conditions will look like in those years. And so we're kind of sustaining where we'll be with the program that is currently adopted on the good roads, or the roads that are already in good condition. The roads that are in poor condition, those are roads that have a road quality index of 2 or under. Those are really rough roads. This is not the same scale as the other one. The other one was in 10% increments. If we did this, you wouldn't be able to see it. But this is, we're down in the 3, 4, 5, 6% range. But we have made some progress there, too, in terms of maintaining the principal arterials. Are we've kind of, they're not where we'd like them to be, but they were at about 2.6%. We'd like it to be down under 2%. But it's the non-principals that are, and those are mostly the low-volume roads. Some of our roads carry as few as 500 cars a day. Those are getting rougher and rougher, and given our forecast, we look like they're going to increase the percentage and the miles that are going to be in poor condition. We also are looking forward. We've made progress on our interregional corridor system, but we know that as traffic increases, congestion is going to increase, and so our speed target there that we'd like our roads to be able to operate where a long trip, you could average 55 or 60 miles an hour on those roadways, that's going to be a challenge maintaining that. In the metro area, again, we've had some successes in the past few years with some of our major projects, like finishing 694 up in the northwest corner of the metro area and the 494 expansion in Minnetonka and Eden Prairie there, and even some of our smaller, lower-cost fixes, like adding the lanes on Highway 100 made a significant improvement into our congestion reduction and what we kind of call scabbing in a lane that we did over on 94 near McKnight, that those have really not only shown up in those corridors, but they've shown up when we put them on the whole system. But unless we keep doing a lot of those either major projects or low-cost projects, we're going to be seeing things coming back and congestion increasing. As Bernie mentioned, we have had great success in reducing fatalities through a comprehensive effort of both changing the engineering and emergency services and education and enforcement. And we now, that 494 in 2006 was the lowest number of fatalities since World War II. So that was quite an accomplishment. But again, this is a challenge. This isn't something you just do and rest on your laurels. It's something that will be there in the future as well. And then a new challenge that has come, and we're not quite sure what it means and what we're supposed to do about it in terms of how we build the transportation system, is the whole issue of climate change and reducing the CO2 emissions. And transportation is a major contributor, 34%. So we're waiting to sort of see what some of the studies and some of the recommendations come forth that we may want to consider in this plan. Another thing that we've looked at in getting ready to do this plan is to kind of get a sense of scale of what does the revenue and cost outlook for the next 20 years. And as a caveat, again, this is just kind of rough scale. Tom Johnson Hansen, the Department of Finance, said, how can you forecast 20 years when we have to do twice a year just to get the next year? And so this is kind of our best guess, but we do need to do this in order to get some sense of scale as to where we're going. I'm only going to talk about the outlook here for the trunk highway system today and not get into Greater Minnesota Transit or some of the other transit things that are covered by the Metro Council. I think you're all aware that MnDOT's highway funds come from both the state sources, the gas tax, the motor vehicle sales tax, and the registration fees, and then the federal dollars come from, we get both formula funds and then we get the high priority earmark funds. And so these funds all flow through the distribution formulas and end up finally in the state road construction fund. Some of the money goes to operations and then some goes to construction. We need to forecast where each of these are going to be in order to make an estimate of our future funding. So in looking at this, when we did this for the last plan in 2003, we just went back for the last 20 years and said the last 20 years is pretty good. Things went like this with revenues and costs, but we think the next 20 years will look like the last 20 years. When we look now at the last 20 years, 1990 to 2000 was a whole different environment than we've seen since 2000. 1990 to 2000, some of these factors that we had very high growth in revenues for transportation. We had very high employment levels in the state. We had high incomes. We had a booming housing economy, so a lot of people could get easy credit. They could do a home equity loan and buy another car. They were buying, this was the era of SUVs. Everybody was buying those big cars, big gas guzzlers. Gas was relatively cheap. The population of the state was growing at 1.2%, and people were driving a lot. VMT was growing at, that's vehicle miles traveled, was growing at like 2.7% a year. Beginning in 2000, and I don't know if it was 9-1-1 or just what, a number of factors, a lot of it is probably the whole global economy and the impact of the third world countries on demand for bituminous and concrete and gas and the growth of China and India. We've seen increasing low growth in our revenues. I mean, we had the change in the TAB fee structure, which was then backfilled some with MVEST, but we had a less stable economy since then. Fuel prices have increased. We've had a very unstable housing market. The population growth rate has slowed, and VMT has slowed a lot. So as we look forward again for this long-term purposes, we have incorporated the Department of Finance projections that they've done for MVEST, but we do the gas tax and TAB fee increases. But so our more immediate reality-based for the 2008 through 11, that's in here. But then we start from there and kind of say, okay, so what does the big long-range picture look like? We are assuming that the high fuel prices are going to continue, that there will be increased environmental regulation, increased use of alternative fuels and more fuel-efficient vehicles, modest growth in population. This is consistent with Tom Gillespie's forecasts, and the gross domestic product and the employment here in Minnesota, modest growth, an aging population, which could have an impact, again, on how much people drive, and better quality vehicles and the lower rate of replacement. People don't buy cars as often as they did. They keep them longer, and so the turnover. So all of these things affect our revenues. So as we look to the gas tax, and I've just shown you kind of what was the rate of growth in the 1990 to 2000 and 2000-2007, we are assuming that the gas tax is going to grow at 1.6% over this time frame, that MVEST is going to grow about 1.6%, and the TAB fees at 1.6%. So those are the assumptions that we've built in for on the state side. On the federal side, it's even more of a challenge to try to figure out, you know, what might we assume the federal government is going to do. We have had significant increase over each of the last federal bills, the last three. And the one that they passed in fiscal year 05 was very generous because they had a big surplus in the Federal Highway Trust Fund, and so the appropriation level just spent down the balance. And they didn't have to raise revenues or anything to do that. So we've had this significant increase as a result of that. In looking to the future, we are assuming that in the short term that the federal government will continue to honor what they've put in their legislation, the appropriation at that in the fiscal year in the 05 federal bill. Even though it is forecast that to do so they will be a negative $4.3 billion, but they have a lot of options that they could do. They could either raise the federal gas tax, or they could put a general fund contribution. They could do a lot of mixing around with the discretionary funds and what they fund and don't fund and some of those things. So for now, we are assuming, though, that they will honor that. If they don't, we've got some contingency plans we're working on, but that then we're keeping it, though, at that level through 2015, so that's a pretty conservative estimate. And then assuming that it will grow at that point, like we're assuming gas tax revenues in general, because the trust fund is based on the federal gas tax. Now, one other thing that we've had to kind of make some assumptions about is what's going to happen with inflation. And we have assumed that inflation is not going to be as bad as it's been in the recent years. We've had, if you look at just the last 8 years here, it's annualized at about 7%. We've had some years it was 14, 20%. So it's really been, especially just the last couple of years, we've just had very dramatic increases. But we think it's going to come down and moderate 7.654, and by around 2020 or so, we're assuming it's back to what it was, about 3%. In the 1990s, construction costs were almost lower than the consumer price increase. We were really benefited from that. We had a lot of really high buying power with our dollars, and now it's been really reduced buying power. But we think that's going to come back because of a number of factors. So if you put this all together, this is just a chart that shows our growth in revenues. And you can see the tab fee reduction. And then when the MVEST comes in, and this assumes the MVEST fully by 2012 coming in and dedicated to transportation. Now, this is at the level. This is for all. This is for MnDOT and the cities and the counties. We all share this source here, so I haven't gotten to just MnDOT yet. But one thing I wanted to show you here is this is kind of, so it shows we're growing, but if you take the trend line we had in the early 90s, and if you were to continue that, you can see what a much sharper slope. So we are much flatter. The significant thing is this line that we've put on here is total revenue adjusted for inflation. So our buying power, this is kind of the challenge. Our buying power is declining. Senator Carlson.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to the MVEST growth and the fact that we're declining in the MVEST, have you looked at if we were to have the lease tax MVEST also in there, would we still be declining compared to where we were before, or would that picture change?
The lease tax that has been suggested by others.
Right.
We have not, for our purposes, we have not changed anything. This is current law.
Right. I just wondered if you have ever looked at that metric.
No, I haven't. At this point,
okay.
I'm just
Thank
looking
you.
At kind
okay.
of what we know today.
Okay.
Ms. Riker.
Thank you. So putting this together, the of all the state funds, when you go through the formula in the Constitution, of how much ends up coming into the state trunk highway fund, these are our forecasted amounts. And of that, much of that state money goes to operations and maintenance and debt service. So about 36% right now is going to the state road construction budget that's actually out there to build bridges and do big pavement jobs and build the 494s and those sorts of things. And then federal aid that comes in, we do share that also with the cities and counties, and we on average get about 68% of that federal formula funding that comes in. So this is our forecast, and if you look at the total here, we're at about $635 to $700 million annually per year in the years 2012 to 18, and then beyond that, it increases, and it's $715 to $825. The other thing we've needed to do then is look at, okay, if that's how much money we're going to have, we're starting to, and we're just at the very beginning, starting to get a sense of, well, what are going to be some of our needs over this time period? And so we started with just preserving the system because that is our first priority, and that's the thing that we have more base models that we can do projections on. So in looking at pavements and looking at those charts I showed you before about where we are now with our pavement conditions, we are forecasting that we're going to need to spend between $400 and $450 million a year in the 2012 to 18 period to maintain, to get our pavements to meet targets and to maintain them thereafter. Bridges, regular bridges, we are in the $120 to $135 million range. And I want to point out that in that, it assumes that we are, our model says we're going to be taking care of all the structurally deficient bridges that become structurally deficient in this time period are being taken care of, and also any fracture-critical bridges that need something to be done with them are in here. So we have a big model, a big decision tree that looks at the type of bridge and how old it is and what condition it's in. So we have a big asset management system for pavement and bridges. In addition to those, we have, in that first time frame, we have six major river crossings that need to be replaced. Lafayette, Hastings, Dresbach, Winona, St. Cloud has the one in over Highway 23, and the Cayuga Bridge, which is part of 35E, just north of here.
Senator Saltzman.
Because Senator Sieben isn't here, and I know that she's very concerned about the Hastings Bridge, and there's another bridge in there, the St. Croix River Crossing, that is in my district, that is not in those six bridges.
It's in the – that's what that one – that $26 million in the second time frame is annualized cost of doing the current – the current program date is 2024 for the Stillwater Bridge, and, you know, it could move, but we're just sort of – again, this is just rough approximate, but that is one bridge, actually, that $26 million is the Stillwater Bridge in 2024.
Okay.
Senator Saltzman.
So, Mr. Chair, where is the Hastings Bridge in this? Is that in the 2012-18?
Yes. Or it would be? Right now it is.
Okay. So do you have you're talking about these all six of these projects that you just listed would be in the 2012 to 2018?
Yes. Actually, right, Lafayette starts in 2011, but it has this is kind of in payout year, year of construction dollars here. This is what we think, given that. I'm sorry.
No, I did call your name, but it's all right.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Excuse me. Could I hear the question again?
Sure. I wanted to know, Mr. Chair, that are all these six bridges covered with the $56 million per year between 2012 and 2018?
Ms. Reichert.
Senator Carlson. Senator Saltzman. That includes the $56 million is our current estimate for the cost of the structures only in those bridges. They're still figuring out what it's going to really cost to, like, build Lafayette to make it connect at both ends. It's probably going to be double that by the time you actually finish them. But we're still early, and we're still trying. This is why this is very preliminary. We're still working on all of this, but, you know, this is the early numbers to kind of give you. So this is the structure only, the approaches to connect them. So you could say roughly it might be $112 million for those, but that's all six bridges on an annual average. You know, the thing is, some of these bridges may be all at one time, you know, so they aren't going to be done. So we're working on when to program them, how to do them. It's not only when do they need to be done, what can we afford, and so we don't disrupt traffic. If you have two bridges in the same corridor kind of going at the same time, it could be a problem. So the Metro District is looking at how they're going to do Lafayette and Hastings in all of these. Just as the Rochester District is looking at doing Winona and Dresbach in that time frame as well.
Senator Rolstein.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I have a little problem with my math here because the last estimate I've heard for the Stillwater Crossing is up to $500 million. And I don't see how $26 million works into there.
Well, again,
Ms. Riker.
Senator Carlson, Senator Olson. Well, that's the structure only, and it is not, and that's Minnesota's share, not Wisconsin's share as well. But again, this is very kind of rough numbers. But that's over 26, so really it's over 10 years, so it's $260 million. That's one bridge.
So that actually could actually
Senator Goldstein.
Oh, thank you.
That's just the structure portion, not the approach portion.
I guess a follow-up would be that are you looking at alternative means of paying for that bridge? Because I hear you saying that $26 million a year over 10 years, $260 million, so it probably would be enough to pay for that bridge. But and I recognize, too, that this is looking off quite a ways into the future. But by that time, I suspect that bridge will be $1 billion. So has there been any talk of maybe a toll bridge or a toll authority or anything like that to fund that particular bridge?
There's a whole – oh, Senator Carlson. Senator Olson. There's a whole group of – there's a whole project team working on that bridge and funding options and federal funding options and other options, and all that's been – I just sort of take their things and try to put the big picture together here.
Thanks.
Ms. Reichert, then how – I guess I'm trying to figure out. I know what Senator Olson is going after here, but I'm having a hard time understanding it, too. What constitutes this number? It seems like we all know that it's quite low, extraordinarily low.
This, Senator Carlson, this number is the structures only that need to be built in those years. So for the case of Stillwater, it's the estimate of the structure of Stillwater. And that was one bridge. So it was over 10 years. It was $260 million in year of construction starting in 2024. And then we divided by 10 to come up with an annual average. That's how we got 26. So the structure, if you double the structure and say that's kind of the approach, our share of the approach, that's almost your $500 million that he's talking about, and the other $500 million maybe is Wisconsin. I mean, it is a very expensive bridge. I think what I was trying to walk through here is that, you know, we've kind of tried to do this. We've also added in here other infrastructure, signs, signals, drainage. We don't have as elaborate asset management systems developed for those, but we've tried to do some rough estimates about what do we need to spend annually to keep those in good repair, like the signs that Bernie was talking about, those big freeway signs. A lot of those have been there for a long time, and it's time to – they're going to need to be replaced over this time frame. So if you add all this up on an annual basis from the first – planning period from 12 to 18 to do preservation only. This is not expansion projects. This is not IRC project. This is not dealing with metro congestion. To preserve our system, it looks like we'll require around $600 to $700 million a year over that time frame. And our forecasted revenues are between $635 and $700 in that first time frame. And then if you go out to the next time frame, you can see what the range of estimate of need is. And again, this is just to preserve the system. This isn't other things.
Senator Saltzman.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm having some problems with these numbers because this is how we're planning and looking ahead. And certainly the St. Croix River Crossing, even if the $26 million is there, one of the big questions is that the Wisconsin folks have all their infrastructure done on the other side. They're ready to go. And Highway 36, We have frontage roads that are literally crumbling. I mean, when we talk about crumbling infrastructure, this is. And where's the money for that? And I'm looking at 2012 to 18, and if that is 7 years times the $56 million, you know, $400 million to build six bridges, and 35W Bridge is what, you know, $300 million. And I know there's some federal money there, but I'm looking at sort of some fuzzy math here that some of these bridges, absolutely, this, you know, this is, these are real problems. And
yes.
I'm not sure that these are real numbers when we look at replacing them. And I guess maybe we're not, like, we're missing something here, because I don't see how we're going to get these projects done. And I guess that when we look at the Stillwater River crossing, you know, that is almost 20 years from now. It's almost a joke. It's almost a joke to sit here and say that the people in my district and the people who are, you know, the businesses that are trying to use that, 20 years from now doesn't even seem like reality. That the congestion that is absolutely clogging up the main street in Stillwater, the environmental impact, I just look at this and it just kind of looks like sort of like a very, it's nice to see the numbers, but I don't see that this is really realistic.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Parker.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps I could add something to this discussion. I think it's really important to understand what this kind of activity is, what it is about. It is not an activity to determine what year we will do, what year we will construct certain projects, or even how much they will cost. This is a planning, a long-range, very rough, very preliminary planning activity to sort of get a general idea of what sorts of things will fall in clumps of years and how much money we will have in clumps of years, so that we can start the discussion about how to figure these things out. The actual activity of figuring out what year to construct a certain project and the criteria that go into making that decision are actually part of a different kind of activity, where we actually look at the investments for each of those bridges as they come closer to their time and determine what to do. And we are all very aware of all of the needs in the state for all of, for bridges and for pavement everywhere. But the determination about when to do the Hastings Bridge is part of a different kind of activity than this attempt to look ahead 30 years from now and try to guess how much revenue will we need over that long period, and what is the totality of all the projects that will fall into that. It's very much like Ms. Reichert described in the beginning, of the sort of thing that wise people do when they're young, if they start to plan for their retirement years, looking ahead to see what the prospects are. And it is the kind of activity you do during this period that helps you make better decisions as you get back down into the closer period. You know, we have the State Transportation Investment Plan right now, which goes out, is a 4-year period, and we actually have to know where the money will come from for each of the projects in there. And those projects have been picked by MnDOT and the ATPs. But that is a different kind of project from this very preliminary, very long-range planning that goes into the development of a plan about how to prepare for the future. And these numbers will not add up to any kind of math that you can bank on, because that isn't their purpose. These are mostly to give scope to the discussion about how to prepare for the future and what steps we need to take.
Senator Salzman.
None of this is very reassuring to the people I talk to who don't want to drive across our bridges. To say that this is to determine when it's closer to their time. We have bridges out there that we can't start, I guess, theorizing what kind of resources we're going to have in 10 years, because we have bridges right now that, if the public is truly trying to take alternate routes because they don't have to drive across a bridge, we have a problem. And it's almost as if we're backing into these numbers instead of looking at what are the real needs of this state it's really, it seems that we're going in the opposite direction. In that, well, how much money might we have, and then we'll think about what we can do. And in a perfect world where we've maintained our bridges, that works. But when we have bridges that people truly don't want to drive across, I don't know that this kind of planning is very useful. And I appreciate your work. But I'm just expressing for those of us who are on the front line with the public, who people are saying to us, when is this bridge going to get done? And we're looking 20 years out. It doesn't really seem like the project is being taken very seriously.
Ms. Reichert.
There's no response. There's no response to that, but I would just like to clarify that what this is showing is that of our projected available revenues, it will take all the money we have to simply do this, to preserve the essential infrastructure. And if you want to move Stillwater up into the first time frame, you can just sort of see where it is. And so we were trying to get a sense of scale on how are we, how in balance are we, and what are our challenges. And so, again, this is only looking at pavement and bridge and a little other infrastructure. There's no congestion mitigation in here. There's no interregional corridor. There's no interchanges to support local development that people want. And we can kind of get into that is kind of the next part of this. But this is just to look at. And it looks like preservation is our first priority. It looks like, given how things are currently planned, it's going to be a challenge with the revenues we have to do that. That's kind of the message.
Just one more question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Salzman.
Thank you. If you are with planning for the state, how do you involve the business community with this about what their needs are? Because if we're truly doing planning, here it looks like we're doing preservation. But in many of my conversations with the business community, and they're looking at our infrastructure as what really helps to drive our economy, if we're just preserving the status quo and we're looking at hopefully growth and we're looking at businesses now saying our current infrastructure is not working for us, have you taken that into account in what is needed to truly address the long-term needs of this state? If you're not talking about improvements or corridors, how have you taken the needs of business into account?
Ms. Reichert.
Senator Carlson. Senator Salzman, if I could go on to how we did the last plan and how we're going to update this, we do take those needs into account. And we do, for instance, I'm meeting with the Chamber of Commerce in 2 weeks to share this and get their input too. So we're just at the very beginning. This was just to get some preliminary idea. What does it look like? Because if I could move on and show you some of how we do that long-range planning, and it'll just take a minute.
Senator Day.
I can maybe help Senator Saltzman a little bit. On the Wakota Bridge, how we got involved is we almost rebuilt all of Newport and Cottage Grove with state funds in those communities. And if you go look at any of the streets all around it, there were state funds that we did there. As far as the Stillwater Bridge, we've been here for 15 years on the Stillwater Bridge, and if Stillwater and the people against zebra mussels and all of the other things would get their act together, we would have had Stillwater done a long time ago. But the community doesn't know where they even want the bridge, and the arguments are amongst the cities out there. It isn't amongst us. We've sat here and listened to this for so long that, if we're the only state that has municipal approval for anything. So the city of Owatonna could stop a bridge being built in Owatonna for 20 years if they wanted to. But I'm going to tell you, we're having a tough time with some of these bridges accomplishing what we want to, because we can't get the people, the businesses of the communities saying, can we please build a new bridge across there? And then it's like, well, no, because, we don't really know if we wanted to go across there, and then we don't know if this is going to take some of this land and that land, and the first thing you know, it all falls apart. 17 years ago when I first got here, Gary Lighting, he sat at tables talking about the Stillwater Bridge, and I thought, oh, okay, 5-10 years, we're going to have this thing pretty well accomplished. So I don't know if we had all the money today that anybody would know if they would agree to where the bridge is going to go. I'd be surprised if they would know that.
Senator Saltzman.
I just want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Day for your knowledge of this process. But I believe that the Lackawanna communities have worked together and are working together. I do not support the Sierra Club lawsuit that has been filed right now, because I think we need to get this done, and I'm prepared to work with my community. But if the money is 20 years out, how can you plan a bridge for 20 years from now? It's very, very difficult.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think we this was presented that you're just starting the planning process.
Yes.
We're kind of putting you in a difficult spot to require that we look at these and look that they're hard and fast. You're just giving us an idea of what the circumstances are now, what some of the projections are, as you're gathering data to come up with a plan. Not you're not presenting that to us, and it would seem to me, I think the idea of giving us an outlook of just how you project preservation of what we have in light of your goals, and with these resources, at least it gives you a framework. And I think it's our job. As you said, we haven't allowed you to get to the place of projections and looking ahead, but the policies that we set here are the ones that also help to drive those plans and also to set what those requirements are that we're going to have to try to either raise money here or and also project or hope that we might continue to get some federal money toward that end. Hopefully when I think of interstate systems and these major bridges, we kind of owe an awe that they are actually paying for the full amount of the 35W bridge. I think they ought to. If they're interstate highways, why isn't the federal government paying for all of that? All of our interstates, all of the maintenance, all of the, that would be a good federal role, it would seem to me. If they would just keep up with those costs, we would our money would go an awful lot further toward our state and county and local roads. But anyway, I digress there on that one. But it seems that hopefully your plan will give us a framework that also will lead to our some deliberation and some good discussion as to what it is we are trying to achieve and how we get there.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Parker and Ms. Reichert, I think what you're hearing is a request on behalf of some of us in the legislature to have your planning be a reflection of what you know the people want, and that it's, I share Senator Saltzman's concern. When I saw the plan for the Stillwater Bridge being put under there, I understand that perhaps you put it there looking at available resources, but I'm looking for leadership, and I would ask that you consider doing your strategic plan from the perspective of being a leader in MnDOT to say, we know that this Stillwater Bridge, we can't wait 20 years. Let's put it in here, and let's see how far in the red we go. And then I would welcome looking at a MnDOT report that shows us in the red so that you hold us accountable. And you say, legislature, it's up to you to make something happen here. We're telling you what needs to happen for the people. And we expect you to do your part to deliver that. So that's where I'm at, is that I don't blame you, because you're looking at what you've got. And so then you're fitting what you see into what you've got. And we're asking that you might consider it from another perspective.
Mr. Chairman?
Ms. Olson. Senator Olson.
I guess I have a hard time seeing that that's their job, is to be the leaders. I mean, I think that's our job. And they carry out the plans. Our bureaucratic agencies are to fulfill the plans that we give them the direction and the resources to do. And to suggest that they have to be leading, I think in terms of maybe we would think this is conservative, but the reality is this is the investment we've made. What we've heard thus far is this is what is going to be needed to maintain and preserve the infrastructure that we've got. And now, maybe you've got more coming. We haven't heard that as to whether you've heard or whether some of these projections are ones that you're going to make recommendations based on. But right now, I think what we're reacting to is exactly what you should be doing.
One follow-up. Thank you, Senator Olson.
Senator Black.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson. I don't have the expertise to be a leader in determining when these roads and bridges need to be done because I'm not an expert on that. So when I say leadership, I don't mean in terms of, you know, telling us what the legislature should do. I'm saying, given your expertise about roads and bridges and structural deficiencies, if you were going to do a long-range plan in a perfect scenario, when would these projects be, not even perfect, good? Not perfect, good. When would you attend to these projects, and what would that look like? So not, you know, a direction from, I'm not abdicating our responsibility. I'm just saying I do trust your expertise more than those of us sitting at this table.
And I want to echo what Senator Bonhoff and Senator Saltzman are driving at also. MnDOT has the expertise. You have the information. You have the people to assess what these roads are like and what is and what isn't up to standard. And I think I agree that you should be putting that plan out there for us to either agree with, or maybe we don't want to agree with it, but it should be a plan that reflects your expertise. We need your professional expertise. And I'm going to say that as hard and strong as I can, your professional expertise that comes from that department. And that's what we need to do, is we need to see from you what needs to be done. And you were mentioning that it's going to come from, you're going to go and see the Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber of Commerce needs to have that told to them very strongly, that this, under your professional expertise, we know that there is a congestion. We know that there's asset preservation needed. If you don't do it, you're going to be put at risk here of some economic damage, which is what we're at right now. So we need you. We need the Department of Transportation, which has lots of abilities with professionals, to lead.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, let me just use a little, it's a smaller, for instance, but it's in my district. I don't have the big Stillwater Bridge and some of the other things, but I've got to meet with a city council on Monday, and there's a kind of a face down coming with both Met Council and MnDOT. Potential development projections, and they don't want to take action on a development because the road capacity, they fear, will be inadequate for this. Well, the philosophy or the policy that MnDOT has, and I presumably that's at the direction of state legislature or wherever, that they don't build in advance of needs. I mean, you're having hard enough keeping up with what's there afterwards. So to expect that somehow you're going to have a plan and that you have this on the docket, and then the development will come, or then we should be allowing it, that's a disagreement. So at some place, you do have to be following a policy. So, you know, I'll either have to take the flack from them that's saying, right now the policy is we don't go out there and build roads, and then hope they will come. We tend to respond. You're tending to respond to when that pressure is there and it gets great enough, then you do it. Now, if somehow we want a different policy here, I think that needs to come from the direction of the leadership or the legislature, not just MnDOT. Now, or if you're setting it and we don't like it, then we certainly have the prerogative to tell you we want you to function with a different policy. But the point is, are we going to have a responsive policy in terms of the way in which we deal with this, or are we going to be trying to be ahead of the game? In this case, we're having an expectation. What the people want is, I don't know how you know that in the first place. We have a hard enough time projecting that. should our policy be that the infrastructure should be out there before anything else happens? That would be nice. Or how is that developed cooperatively, or is it a responsive mechanism? And that's the tough part of planning. And so I don't think we should be, I guess I'm trying to get at the point, we shouldn't be nailing you on that. Or at the very, if I was paying attention to what you started with, you do meet with a lot of these stakeholder groups. And when you actually get to the plan, which this is not, I mean, this is not your final plan, that you will have some way that shows what some of those ideas or ideals or desires are and what that would be, or various scenarios, and what that would in fact require, along with dealing with the fundamentals of what we have now and how you keep it and maintain those. Am I off kilter, or what's going on here?
Well, no, Senator Olson, I guess I'd like to answer a little bit of that myself here, is that we need to have some vision here, and we have given the responsibility to MnDOT to provide that vision. They do have the ability to assess the condition of the pavements, the condition mm-hmm. of the bridges.
Sure.
And when you said that we don't need to build anything in advance, we sure do. We have to build bridges in advance. I think we're at the point where we need to start design on the Lafayette Bridge long before that bridge is done.
But that's a current bridge.
And that's what we're talking about here, is we're talking about things that haven't been done in the past. We're talking about the Hastings Bridge. We're talking about the Lafayette mm-hmm. Bridge. Now, pavements, that's a different issue. There, you can let them be congested until the locals want you to do something. But in the case of safety, that's something that's highly technical, and it is a long lead time. And I think what we need to count on people here in this professional organization is to come up with the solutions long ahead of when we need to use it. We should be on the Lafayette Bridge right now. I'm sorry. We should be on the Wakota Bridge right now. And because of problems, we're not. We're sitting here with years to go. And those are the kinds of things we need to have some vision to be able to resolve long before we have a problem with finances or with technical issues. So we need to have the people here let loose and practice their skills to their best ability. We can underfund them if we'd like. That's a different issue. But we need folks to tell us what it's going to cost to keep this infrastructure up to date. Ms. Riker.
Senator Carlson, if I could go on, I think I might be able to clarify some of the...
I'm sorry, we're going to probably have to push you along fast because
okay.
we have talked a lot.
Let me say, I just want to tell you, other states are facing the same issue of increasing costs, and that it's going to take almost all their money simply to preserve the existing system we have. In terms of where we go from here, the question is about our vision, and this is what we're asking the stakeholders. It's kind of... what do you want to do, but also what do you want to do with the available money we have today? And if you want more, it's going to take more money. And yes. how much money? And that's up. And we're not there yet, but we're having a discussion. So we have three options for discussion purposes we have laid out. One is we maintain the vision that we had in 2003. We update everything. Or we expand the vision and put in all the other things people say they want. Or number three, we strategically realign the vision. Let me just run through this very quickly. In 2003, our plan, the vision was that we would meet these performance targets. We would preserve the system, all the bridges and all the pavements. We would deal with safety. We would deal with mobility in the Twin Cities and on the IRCs. We wouldn't get rid of all the congestion, but we would keep it from growing as fast. We didn't do it on what we could afford or how much money was there. It was just this was our vision. And in the 2004 plans, district plans, figured out what it would cost. And we came to you and we showed you in 2005 to do all of that. And a lot of people said we didn't have everything in there that we should have. It was kind of a conservative amount, but it did a lot of things. It was $37 billion in 2004 dollars. So that was it. We added some lanes on the metro freeways, and we fixed some of the IRCs, and we preserved the system. We also told you at that time that we had a forecast of available funding of $14.6 billion. So we had a vision of what everybody wanted. What I was doing in this further was I was trying to get at how much money are we going to have versus the vision. We haven't developed the vision yet, but the amount of money that we now have in real dollars and buying power isn't as rosy as we thought it was in 2005. It's lower. And so that's out of all of our control. That's because I just told you about revenues are flat and the buying power is going up. And it's been very significant. So we told you back then that it was $1 billion a year gap. We told you that in 2005. If we would keep this plan and we just update the costs and the revenues in this plan that we had in 2003, it'll be a much bigger gap than $1 billion a year. So part of the planning process here is, you know, what do we do? Is this it, or do we do we expand our vision? In essence, we'd have a bigger gap, but is that what we should do? Should we put all the things in the vision that everybody has said? We have gone out and we have listened to everyone. Most of the state says all those IRCs, they'd like most of them, if they're a four-lane expressway, they want them to be a freeway. If it's a two-lane road, they want it to be a four-lane road. There is a significant to handle all the growth and to do it so everybody can drive in single-occupant vehicles, one person per car, you know. They would be significant expansion of the metro freeway system and arterials. We could cost all that out. In rural Minnesota, they are talking about the 10-ton road network that needs to be upgraded a lot. We could add that to our vision. We could add capacity and access for all local development, all these interchanges. There's 30 or 40 interchanges around the state that people would think we should be building. We could add capacity and do a lot for trucks. The trucking industry thinks we should do things to help them. We could do a lot in transit. We could do a lot in freight. We could do this, and that $1 billion gap we had before could be, you know, and that's kind of, you know, we kind of plan for the money you give us. So this is, we're trying to lay out parameters. The third option people are saying is that since that $1 billion gap has grown so much, maybe we need to strategically realign and look at what can we really do to look at multimodal investments that preserve the system, improve safety, but optimize the use of existing capacity and stretch every dollar to achieve or to maximize and accelerate and distribute the benefits. For instance, you know, doing that early fix we did on 94 at McKnight fixed a problem. We could have done the perfect solution, and we might have had to wait 15 or 20 years to do the perfect solution, but we fixed something and gave people something. After the bridge collapsed, we fixed, it's not perfect, not everyone's happy with what we did with 280 and 94, but you know, traffic is flowing through there, and actually the crashes are down lower than they were a year ago. So the department thinks that perhaps given these incredible cost increases, and some people in the department, we're a big group, we have different visions ourselves. Some people think we need to go this direction. We need to look at preserving our infrastructure, and that we just showed you that's going to take all the money we have now. So I think everyone agrees that there's a need for some more money. You all debate about how much and how to provide it and all this. That's your policy decisions. We can just tell you right now where we stand, that infrastructure preservation is going to take the bulk of the money. If we want to do efficient operations, we want to go out and time. We could retime signals more often and make the arterials flow better. We could get more out of the existing infrastructure. We could stretch our dollars in that way. We could do more of what Bernie was talking about, this low-cost stuff on, you know, doing pavement markings all over the state. That, relative to other things, that's low cost. It's still a lot of money, but we could do things like that system-wide. Those cable barriers is a low-cost kind of thing. We could do some of those things and get some benefits now. It's going to take more money, but we think we could do some of that. We think we could do more of these low-cost system-wide capacity, we call them capacity optimization, the things like we did on Road 100 and at 94. And we could do some of those on our IRCs as well. Maybe we can't make them four-lane roads. Maybe we can add some passing lanes sometimes. Maybe we can do some other things. There will be a need to actually add traditional lanes some places and selective transit improvements that we know that, and we think there's an opportunity to look at things like more of the hot lanes like 394, more of shoulder using the shoulder conversions or adding in a lane where there's some a little right-of-way left. And then finally, things with partnerships. We've had a lot of success pooling our money with the city or the county's money and doing a project together. So we have these sort of three options. Some people think, no, we should do the old, we should just update the last plan. Some people think we should get everybody's wish list out there, and that's what we should present to you. We should put a price tag on it and compare it to, and then we still have to have a fiscally constrained plan. We have to have, what are we going to do with the money we have? Or we can sort of, some people call this strategically realign, right-size the vision. Maybe people have expectations that we're not going to ever be able to meet. Is that the case? Or should we say, oh, no, it's there. Maybe it won't be 20 years. Maybe it'll be 50 years. I don't know. But anyway, we are trying to get a handle on this. We just started with what's it going to cost just to preserve the system. And I think what we're saying is it's going to take, given the climate and these cost increases, it's going to take most of the money. And so if you want to do something more, you know, that's an issue. We think we need to preserve the existing system. That's important for safety for those bridges. What year we do different bridges, you know, we're working on that. But that's kind of the story. And what I was trying to say is that other states, I've got some quotes. We've been looking around. Every state is facing this. Every state. These trends with construction costs and flat revenues is hitting every state. It's hitting the federal government. The challenge of what to do, competing demands on tax dollars. And so everyone's doing this, and everyone's kind of saying, gee, maybe we need to be creative. We're not quite sure what that means yet, but we are here. And so we wanted to just share with you the information we're trying to share with all of your constituents and our stakeholders as we move forward, because this is going to take a big dialogue with all of us as to where do we go from here. And so our next step is to share this, and our steering committee is going to be chewing all on this. I know you will be, and we'll be happy to talk with you more about this. When you get done at the end of the session, whatever direction you have for us, we'll be in here, and we'll move forward.
We've reached our official end time. We'll have some brief questions, real brief. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate this last part, and so perhaps we did jump down your throat, and
that's okay.
But I do think that it was seeing that Stillwater Bridge out there 20 years that really, you know, because we just don't want that.
Yep.
You know, there isn't anybody who wants that.
Sure.
And so that was just some clear feedback. And we would like to see your best case vision, and we welcome that. So I appreciate the direction that you took the proposal.
Thank you.
Senator Olteen,
Mr.
real brief.
Chair, thank you. Briefly, it was a good discussion. I think it was important that we had this, but I guess I would be interested in seeing, you know, this is our plan under current structure. If our gas tax was 10 cents more a gallon, this is what it would look like. You know, just a different option in labeling it so that under a scenario of a different gas tax or different vehicles fees or something, we would have this amount of dollars, and this is what we would be able to do. That's something that when I'm looking at long-range planning, I think that would have been a nice tool for us to see.
Well, we did share that with the legislative staff, and I, for time purposes, I did not – I'm sorry, Senator.
Go ahead.
I did not put that slide in here, but we know what a nickel would generate, and we know what a dime would generate, and you know, if you go, well, it's a nickel's around $45 million to MnDOT statewide per year.
Ms. Reichert, I think we're probably talking about what roads it would generate and what bridges it would generate.
Well,
so it might be a little bit too much detail for.
We're not ready at that
yeah,
point, but.
Right.
Mr. Chair, what was your.
Senator Langstedt.
The 5 cents raised how much?
I think it was Senator Carlson's.
Ms. Reichert.
Senator Lang says, I believe.
Mr. Gray, you have the answer.
Well,
$18 million a penny to the Trunk Highway.
Well, yeah. A nickel.
His record.
Senator Carlson, a penny generates about $19 million annually. So a nickel is about $95 million. But again, not all of that goes to construction. If we say 50 to 65% of it, right now only 36% of the dollars is going to construction because we need to do our operating costs. If we say, well, if we got more money, we wouldn't have to put as much of it into operations. But we know that we're short on the operations side as well. So if we put 50 to 65% of that, that's like 47 to 62 million would end up in the construction fund statewide. You take 62 million and distribute it around eight districts, and it's, you know.
Mr. Chairman, the 19 Senator million Langsett. Is what the Trunk Highway Fund would get, right?
Yes.
Because
this is just,
I think it's up around 30 million total.
Yes, yes. This is what would come to MnDOT and then to the construction fund in MnDOT.
You know, Mr. Chair, Senator the thing Langsett. Is so frustrating to me. The commissioner was in my office, and she said the 5 cents will raise about 160 million, and that isn't near enough. So she was basically saying there's no point in doing it. And I said it would come $160 million closer to enough. And I just can't quite understand the philosophy of this administration who thinks it's, if you can't do enough, do nothing. And that just baffles me, absolutely baffles me. And year by year by year, here we go. And we've allowed them to borrow money, which I thought was a mistake without any debt service money, and that's been spent. And I don't know. I've never seen us flounder the way we are now floundering. Well, and I will just make a prediction. I will predict no matter what we come up with, the governor is going to veto it. He just will. And I don't know.
Senator Langsett, I share your frustration. And not only that, but I share the fact that it hasn't been done for several years now, so the pent-up demand is getting worse and worse and worse, and it's going to take longer and longer to fix this up.
Mr. Chairman, that
Senator Olson.
That several years is about 20 years. You can't look at just this one. I mean, we need to resolve this, and we need to sit down and work at it and work toward a resolution rather than just butt heads. So I hope we can keep working toward a solution, or at least inching our way, because we have this problem because we haven't addressed it in an incremental way over those last 20 years. And if it's Senator Saltzman isn't here in the 17 years or 20 years, it's taken 50 years to get the resolved to a bypass and a route to improve Highway 12 going west through Orono and Long Lake. And I think it will be done next year at long last. So it's these things are not easy on some of these major projects, but the resources clearly is an issue, and I think we all understand a bit of why that loggerheads is if somebody said, if I can't have all that I want, you're not going to have all you want. And that relates to the roads and bridges have been held hostage, and virtually everybody needs roads and bridges. Even most of our transit usage needs to use the roads and bridges, and we have not been able to keep up with that, and we've got to face that and get past that battleground. So I hope we can do it.
Well, Senator Olson, I really need to make sure that we understand what our problem is here. It's been at least 30 years, and in fact, the governor said when he ran for office, when he announced on September 8th of 2001 that he was running for office, and he mentioned 30 years that it's been underfunded. Well, it has still been underfunded. And rather than saying that it belongs to somebody over a long period of time, a problem like this doesn't get less clear as time goes on. It is now more clear than it was yesterday, last year, 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's more clear right now. So the people who are doing nothing today are the ones that are holding that problem. With that, we're going to adjourn.